Hello, and welcome to College Towns into Knowledge Towns on the future of town-gown relations, brought to you by the History Department and the College of Arts and Sciences at The Ohio State University, and the magazine, Origins, Current Events in Historical Perspective. My name is Nick Breifogel. I'm an associate professor of history and director of the Goldberg Center for Excellence in Teaching, and I'll be your host and moderator today. Welcome to everyone, and thank you so much for joining us. The COVID-19 pandemic accelerated existing trends that put at risk the viability not only of many colleges and universities, but also the towns and cities in which they are located. With the post-COVID-19 shift to more remote work and millions of people moving to more affordable and livable cities, a place that wants to attract talent will require a thriving academic environment. This represents a new opportunity for Town and Gown to create dynamic, thriving communities. Today, Professor David Staley outlines a talent magnet strategy that offers colleges and towns a plan of action for regeneration, affording institutions of higher learning the opportunity to reinvent themselves and become talent magnets. Let's take a moment to get to know our speaker. David Staley is a historiographer, writer, designer, futurist, and journalist, and was recently described as an eclectic academic. He's an associate professor in the Department of History at The Ohio State University, and is the author of many books, including Alternative Universities, Speculative Design for Innovation in Higher Education, which is just out in paperback. He's the co-author of Knowledge Towns, Colleges and Universities as Talent Magnets, which is a book that will be the basis for this discussion today. And he's the author of Visionary Histories, a collection of future essays. In 2022, he received the Best Freelance Writer Award by the Ohio State, the Ohio Society of Professional Journalists for his next Futures column. With that introduction, let me mention the plan. Professor Staley will open with a presentation on universities as talent magnets for urban areas, and then he'll take your questions and we'll open things up for discussion. If you're interested in asking a question, please write it in the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen on Zoom. We'll do our best to answer as many questions as we can. We received several questions in advance that we'll start with. And as a reminder, this event will be recorded, posted at a later date on YouTube, and made available to everyone who has registered for the webinar. Also, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge that the land The Ohio State University occupies is the ancestral and contemporary territory of the Shawnee, Potawatomi, Delaware, Miami, Peoria, Seneca, Wyandot, Ojibwe, and Cherokee peoples. Specifically, the university resides on land ceded in the 1795 Treaty of Greenville and the forced removal of tribes through the Indian Removal Act of 1830. We want to honor the resiliency of these tribal nations and recognize the historical contexts that have and continue to affect the indigenous peoples of this land. Now, let me pass you over to Professor David Staley. Over to you, Dave.
Nick, thank you so much, both for that introduction and also the invitation to speak. You and I were talking before we went on here about Clio Society, and for a number of years, I was in your shoes, inviting people to speak at Clio Society, including you. You gave a terrific talk on water, the history of water, and so I'm doubly honored to be able to speak here in the Clio Society for the first time. So I'm very appreciative of that. Thank you. I wanted to begin maybe with a little bit of a history lesson, and to show you this image of Franklin College. Although when it was founded, it was called Alma College, or the Alma Academy initially. It was founded in 1818 and in New Athens, Ohio. I had to go to Google Maps to locate New Athens, Ohio. But it was one of many small liberal arts colleges that dotted and continue to dot the landscape of Ohio. I sometimes joke with my students that in Ohio, at least, you can't swing a dead cat without running into a small liberal arts college someplace. It seemed like every town had a college in it, or at the very least a school or an academy. But it it it's it was just a sort of a common feature here in Ohio, and the small little New Athens was no different, nestled in the eastern part of the state in the Appalachian region. Franklin College was, if you don't know its history, was actually pretty well known, an abolitionist college. Educated some of the leading abolitionists, including, and I'm going to blank on his name, but including a future governor of the state of Ohio. Like a lot of colleges in the 19th century, it had probably no more than 100 students at any given time, no more than a dozen or so faculty. But again, in that sense, it was no different or unremarkable in comparison to other schools. And like many small colleges in Ohio and elsewhere, in 1919, it shuttered its doors. It no longer exists except as a museum. And one of the questions that I'll ask, but I won't answer here today, but something that interests me is why this otherwise successful college, Franklin College, shuts down in the 19th century or the early part of the 20th century, but so many other small colleges that were founded at the same time haven't. Before I came to Ohio State, I taught at a school called Marietta College on the Ohio River. I then spent a number of years at Heidelberg College, founded in 1850. Heidelberg was founded in 1835. Why are those colleges still around today, whereas Franklin wasn't? And if I can give a simple answer to a complex question, those colleges changed because they had to, because of the nature of the marketplace of higher education. Those institutions are alive today because they changed, they transformed from their original founding. And I think the lesson I want to draw from this is that I think we're in a very similar sort of moment where a lot of colleges and universities face the threat of closing. And we've seen the higher education press every day, more and more colleges that are either merging with others or forced to shut down. And I think that those that survive are going to have to change, are going to have to transform. We know that especially in small towns and in rural areas, colleges are an important lifeline. This is a New York Times article that's talking about the larger consequences of these colleges and universities shutting down. What is the impact on the towns in which they reside? And one of the arguments that we make in our book is that we want to address exactly this sort of problem, but not with the kind of solutions that colleges and their towns have always engaged in. And this is an issue that we are confronting right now. What is it that small colleges can do to thrive? And again, what we're proposing here is a very different kind of strategy than I think most institutions are dealing with today or are approaching today. Just some more background context to this. This is in Pennsylvania, which has a number of colleges and universities, and state leaders, state authorities are wondering, maybe we have too many. Maybe we have too many colleges and universities, and we have to shut some of them down. And it has to do with the number of, it has to do with the population, especially the population of traditional age students, 18 to 24 year olds. The working title of our book, right up until the moment we published it really, was A College in Any Town. So in many ways, our argument was going completely counter to what's happening in places like Pennsylvania. So last minute, we decided to call it not college towns, but knowledge towns. Kentucky, in some ways, is pushing against this trend. They're exploring, they haven't created yet, but they're exploring the idea of creating a new college in what they term a post-secondary desert. And again, this bucks the trend that we're seeing nationwide, really, about the location of colleges and universities. As Nick was alluding to, an important part of the reason that we wrote the book was we were watching one of the more important trends that was occurring. It actually started before the pandemic, but certainly was accelerated during the pandemic. And it has to do with knowledge workers in particular, knowledge workers moving to new parts of the country. Basically, the trend was that knowledge workers discovered, especially during the pandemic, that I can work from home. I don't have to be in the office to do my job. And if I can do my work from home, then maybe home can be someplace where I actually prefer to be, someplace I'd like to be, someplace that's closer to my family or has more affordable housing or has cultural or other sorts of amenities, better quality of life. In other words, I could be working for a company in San Francisco, but I don't have to live in San Francisco. Maybe I'd like to live someplace where I'd actually rather live. And we've seen, and I'll just sort of quickly go through just some of the statistics about this. These are all New York Times statistics about migration away from the most expensive metros and other large metros, and maybe towards smaller mid-sized and even small metros in rural parts of America. We're seeing more people moving in this direction. And this was fueled by a strategy employed by a number of municipalities. In fact, we give the name to these areas Zoom towns. You can do your work remotely and connect to other employees or to the home office through Zoom. Why not come to rural Vermont, for instance? And so we see we saw a number of these Zoom towns, and part of their strategy was actually to incentivize knowledge workers. This was Tulsa Remote. We will pay you to come and live in Tulsa, to work in Tulsa. And it actually worked. There were quite a number of people. I think it was on the order of about 10,000 or so people moved to Tulsa. Again, they were paid. They were paid money. If you stay here for a year, you'll get, I forget what the amount of money was. It was thousands of dollars. But we saw this in other sorts of places as well. Bentonville, Arkansas, which is in northern Arkansas. Apparently, I'm not a mountain biker, but apparently it is the mecca for mountain bikers in this country. And again, Bentonville was saying to knowledge workers, come live here and we'll give you, as part of the deal, we'll give you access to mountain bike parks. So the idea was to attract those workers here. There were some colleges and universities that got into the act as well. West Virginia, it was three of their universities. They were all attached to West Virginia University. So in Morgantown, and I forget the two other locations. But again, they pay remote workers to come to West Virginia, like $12,000. And included in that was you can have access to the facilities and the expertise at West Virginia. This is very similar to what Purdue University was doing as well. Come live in West Lafayette and you can have access to programming and expertise at Purdue University. All of this led my co-author and I, Dominic Endicott, to ask, what is it that makes a place attractive? What is it that a place could be doing to attract knowledge workers to come and live there? And we think that one of those things is the location of a college or university. We've made a list of our talent magnet strategy. What is it that a town or a region can do to attract knowledge workers? Solve the environmental challenges, make your place green, make the most of the surrounding natural environment and of the cultural and historical environment, create solutions for affordability, encourage community building and combating loneliness. I'll talk in a bit about social capital or the development of social capital, encouraging lives of purpose, supporting ongoing skill formation, incubating novel ideas and enterprises, and we think maybe most important, or certainly among the important elements of this, is that there's a location there of some sort of academic enterprise. We think that collectively, these are things that attract knowledge workers to a place. I'll just very quickly give an example of what I'm talking about here. About a year or so ago, I gave a talk in Fort Wayne, Indiana, about the book. And my host there telling me that he had lived previously in Manhattan and then had spent time in Shanghai, and that he's still working for the same company or working in the same industry, I think, and had just moved to Fort Wayne. And I said, I have to ask, Manhattan, Shanghai, and now you're living in Fort Wayne. Why is that? And he said, first of all, family in the area. He says, but, I have a family now, and I'd like to have a house. Housing here is more affordable in Fort Wayne than anything I could find, certainly in Manhattan or Shanghai. And that process is playing out in all sorts of parts of this country, I think. Just another graphic that sort of demonstrates the approach that we take. We think these are all elements that make a place attractive, especially in drawing in talent in the knowledge economy. I've been doing a little bit of work on rural, especially Appalachia, with the American Enterprise Institute. And we're talking about ways that this talent magnet strategy could be applied to places in Appalachia. These are very attractive places. We think that building colleges and universities in Appalachia could be part of the way that you attract talent to places like Appalachia. And speaking of the American Enterprise Institute, one of my colleagues are actually used to be, Ryan Streeter used to be at the American Enterprise Institute. But in talking about the future of cities, one of the observations he makes is that ideas, and that cities are sort of incubators of ideas, ideas create companies that create jobs, and then people are attracted to these idea-centric environments. And I was really struck by his term, idea-centric environments, that is what attracts people to a location. And again, we think a college and or a university is central to that notion. What else makes a place idea-centric if not the location of a college or university? We argue in the book that that existing college or universities can foster or can be a part of or can lead such a talent attraction strategy for their regions. To do that, though, they are going to have to think differently and indeed be different from what they existed before. We argue in the book that a college or university can do what they've always done, be a liberal arts college, have a business program, have intercollegiate sports, have sororities and fraternities, do all the sorts of things that you've always done, but you're going to have to think differently about expanding that mission, about what it is that you're doing. And so in the book, we say that college and universities maybe need to transform into something we call a knowledge enterprise. And we do that only to draw attention to the differences between an existing incumbent college and what these college and universities will need to be in order to become talent magnets for their regions. So I wanted to lay out what some of these things are. Again, you can be the same sort of institution plus everything that you're doing now, plus each one of these. And I'm not going to go through all the examples we have in the book, but maybe some representative examples. So the first of these is that the knowledge enterprise becomes the region's node, connecting that region to the larger knowledge economy. This quote here comes from the member of the House of Representatives, Ro Khanna, says, this book imagines how the digital economy can create opportunities for people where they live instead of uprooting them, that the digital economy can spread geographically rather than being concentrated in a few hub areas like Silicon Valley or New York or Miami, that the digital economy can spread geographically. And that way people can be a part of it where they are rather than having to uproot. A similar sort of argument was made by the philosopher Roberto Unger in his book, The Knowledge Economy. He says, if you look at the industrial economy maybe began in a few places, but then spread more widely. He says the digital economy needs to do that as well. And we think the knowledge enterprise in a town or in a rural area can be that node to the larger knowledge economy. We think a knowledge enterprise serves as the innovation or creativity cluster for a region, implementing a full range of novel ideas. And I phrase this in such a way to get us out of thinking that this means creating a business incubator, which a lot of places have done. And you can certainly do that. I think when we talk about an innovation cluster, we are talking about a business incubator. And that can exist not just simply in big urban universities and urban centers like Columbus. We have those kinds of business incubators. That can also happen in small rural areas as well. We don't talk about it in the book, but I can point to the innovation hub that's being developed right now in Portsmouth, Ohio. You'd think, wow, Portsmouth, Ohio is this. It turns out that Shawnee State University has one of the leading game design programs in the country. And so there's ways in which Shawnee State and Portsmouth, Ohio can develop as a hub for video game development. I especially wanted to expand the idea that innovation cluster can be about a whole range of novel ideas. And so I have in this chart here, I have like the Bauhaus, that this one up here at the top is Asheville, North Carolina. Black Mountain College. Imagine if Black Mountain College had also been developed as an economic hub, not just simply as an arts hub. The lower right corner, that's one of the, that's the original building of the Savannah College of Art and Design. And we don't mention it in the book, but I think in many ways, SCAD is a quintessential model of what a knowledge town can be. Susan Wallace was developing the idea for SCAD. She wanted to develop a new kind of art school in 1978. She was originally going to have it in Atlanta. And then she made the decision for reasons, she made the decision to move it to Savannah. And at the time people said, you must be insane. Why would you set up shop in Savannah? Because Savannah was economically backward, had all sorts of other challenges. I don't think it's an overstatement to say that SCAD has revitalized Savannah, Georgia. And that the Savannah that we understand today wouldn't be what it is without SCAD. And we'll talk more about that in just a bit. But it's a perfect example of what a college or university can do for economic development for their regions, and that that can happen anywhere. We think a knowledge enterprise also functions as the central, maybe the most important third place for a community. A third place is a reference to a place that isn't home and isn't work. Third place is, well, a place where we gather. It's a place of conviviality, places that we gather. It's usually, in a lot of places, it's the coffee shop, Starbucks, let's say. In Columbus, it could be a place like the public library. But it's places where people gather that's neither home or work. And we argue that that's a role that a college or university can play in its region. And the term I've given for it is a social capital incubator. That part of what a college or university or a knowledge enterprise should be doing is growing or developing social capital, not just financial capital, social capital for a region. This is a quote that has come from a recently published book called The Overlooked Americans. It says, whoops, sorry about that. Social capital and who you're interacting with is hugely important predicting economic mobility. Probably the most important predictor we found to date. Education matters, not just because of what you read in textbooks. In other words, not just simply for the knowledge that you're gaining, but because of whom you meet and the broader knowledge you gain about cultural norms. That's cultural capital. That colleges and universities, without really trumpeting it, are social capital and cultural capital incubators. And this is, again, a key part of what we see as the transformation of colleges and universities into talent magnets. The knowledge enterprise works with the regional economic development team to drive a talent attraction plan. We've said that. The mentorship of students, which we think of as a key part or should be a key part of what our college or university does, extends outward. Mentorship to everyone in the community becomes a vital service offered by the knowledge enterprise. There's a growing body of research. This is just one right here. From Felton and Lambert, called Relationship Bridge Education, that says that if students, and they're talking here about 18 to 24 year old students who form a mentor or connect with a mentor or have a mentorship relationship in their first semester are more likely to graduate, more likely to have better outcomes, more likely to have good positive feelings toward their alma mater than students who don't. And so forging a mentorship relationship is critically important. And again, I think that's something that we in higher education, I mean, we do, I think we do it every day. We don't give it the sort of attention that it deserves. That as professors, for instance, we do more than just profess, we are mentors as well. Mentorship as a service becomes a key part of this. And if I've not said this yet, if what I'm making clear here is that the knowledge enterprise in this model is providing services, not just simply to traditional 18 to 24 year old students. We're talking about providing services to the knowledge workers that are coming to a region as well, expanding who the audience or who the consumers of higher education are. This is, and this is, I think, maybe one of the more controversial claims we make in the book, is that the Knowledge Enterprise serves as a venture capitalist fund, both for faculty ideas and for entrepreneurs in the larger region. We're talking about bringing an incubation cluster or an idea cluster to a region that requires venture capital, which again is concentrated in too few large cities. We're talking about expanding venture capital to a wider area. And again, viewers might this webinar might say, well, a college or a university has no business being a venture capitalist. We shouldn't be in that business. And I just remember that 25 years ago, when colleges and universities were starting to become interested in development in their neighborhoods and were becoming real estate developers, that too was viewed as a really bizarre thing. You know, colleges, universities shouldn't be in the real estate development business. And yet it's now taken as sort of commonplace, certainly in urban universities, that's the case. So maybe this is one of our more controversial claims, that a knowledge enterprise becomes a venture capitalist fund. The knowledge enterprise is physically expansive, expanding outward to across the town such that it becomes a 15-minute campus. And this is playing on the idea of the 15-minute city. And basically what that means is that anybody in a city is within 15-minute walking or cycling or scootering distance. We'd rather it not be driving, but within 15-minute walking distance to the services that you need, grocery stores, doctor's offices, other sorts of things like this. Paris is in the process right now of transforming into a 15-minute city. We're talking about that urban form being the way that you organize and structure a campus. For a lot of campuses, even in small towns in rural areas, the campus is sort of off to one part over here and is sort of aloof from the rest of the city. We're talking about the university physically expanding across more of the city so that wherever you are in the city, you're within walking distance of some aspect or some facet of the university. I was talking about SCAD earlier. It's sort of like the way in which SCAD is the campuses of the campus of the Savannah College of Art and Design is spread, not throughout the entire city, but throughout a significant part of the downtown. All the parts here in yellow on this map are buildings attached to the Savannah College of Art and Design. And as you can see, there are lots of neighborhoods you can be walking in and you will encounter a building, a dormitory or an art gallery or some other sort of building attached to the Savannah College of Art and Design. It's not unlike Oxford University or Cambridge University. The colleges are spread out or dispersed throughout the entire city. We're talking about maybe a sort of constituent college model, not unlike Oxbridge. In addition to being a third place, we argue that a knowledge enterprise should be a fourth place for a community. And fourth place is a term of more recent vintage. And so that means, actually, it means all the other three places together in one location. So a fourth place is a place where you live and work and have your convivial locations, your convivial spaces. And there are a number of these places that are starting to, real estate developers are starting to develop a number of these. We have one in Columbus, that's Gravity. That's the first Gravity. Actually, I think that's the initial architect's sketch of Gravity. But these include apartments and condos. These include office spaces, and they include bars, restaurants, and a gathering place as well. What we're imagining is that colleges and universities get into this business. That what's in a fourth place is not just affordable housing, not just simply offices for knowledge workers, not just simply convivial places, but also classrooms, a campus in a sense, built inside a place like inside a place like Gravity. I mentioned I gave a talk last year in Fort Wayne, and it was here at this at Electric Works, which is exactly one of these, or will be when it's fully developed, will be one of these fourth places. And when I was there in Fort Wayne, I said, which college or university is going to set up shop here at Electric Works? 16 Tech, this is in Indianapolis. This is in a neighborhood in Indianapolis. And again, this is the plan for it, to have residential areas and a hotel and bars and restaurants and other convivial sites. But because this was located near what was IUPU Indianapolis, Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, I again was making the claim last August when I spoke here that a college or university could set up shop here. And in fact, what we talk about in the book is that colleges and universities, rather than arriving at a pre-existing fourth place, are in the business of developing fourth places. I just note, just in the last week or so, that Columbus State has proposed developing affordable housing near their campus. And this is exactly what we're talking about in the book. This is exactly what a college or university can be doing, not just simply in a city like Columbus, but it's the sort of thing that could be happening even in small towns as well. Affordable housing is one of those key features that's attracting people to locations. Affordable housing. In fact, it's what's pushing people away from a lot of places is the lack of affordable housing. So we think that colleges, universities can play a key role in this development. Just as we were finishing it, my attention was drawn to the work of the architect Cedric Price. And this was a plan he developed in the 60s for Staffordshire in the United Kingdom, in England, which at the time was, not to put too fine a point on it, was an industrial wasteland. And so this was his proposal for how that area could be revitalized. And what he said, and again, I think in many ways, this is a great statement of what we are proposing in the Knowledge Towns book. He said, "This project indicates that education and the need to exchange information may be able to equal defense, energy, commercial needs as generators of urban location and form, cities caused by learning." Cedric Price was looking at the fact that what was creating urban forms, or what was generating new cities or revitalization of cities, were things like the defense industry, commercial needs, the energy sector. He was making the argument that universities, that ideas could be that generator of urban form. What he was proposing in what was called the Potteries Think Belt was that rather than building one campus or having one building, England at the time was constructing what were called the red brick universities. What he proposed was extending that campus outward throughout the region. And in fact, you can see the railroads there. He even talked about putting classrooms on railroad cars and moving to where students and faculty are located. It was never actually built, but it was very interesting to see his argument both for the form that a university can take, but that the university itself could come to envelop the idea of the city or town. Defense, energy, commerce, he wrote elsewhere, defense, energy, and commerce have in the past been sufficient generators of cities. This project assumes that education and the need to exchange information may have a similar generative force. Cities can be made by learning, was his argument. And again, we are in many ways channeling Cedric Price and his thoughts about the role that colleges and universities can play in economic development. Again, you could look at this and say, well, this is, you know, what we've always said about town gown. Or you could even say that this is the argument that's been made recently about eds and meds, that we've already seen this, that higher education institutions are already involved in economic development for their regions, but not in the way that we're talking about it. When you look at a typical sort of college town, the college or university plays the role of providing jobs, I think, for people in the area, and providing consumers for local businesses. Go to a place like Bloomington, Indiana, and you see that the town of Bloomington is really there to sort of service the people that reside at Indiana University. We're talking about something much, much different from that—a very different way of thinking about the economic development role that college or university can play. Which is why we didn't call it college towns, In fact, it was Dominic's son who came up with the idea, call it Knowledge Towns. And that was the title that stuck to that. I want to take questions here, but I just want to end on one more thought that I always draw attention to. And I don't know if Dominic is on this call. He and I hadn't talked about this beforehand. I had written a previous book called, and I'll put in a plug if I can, called Alternative Universities. Oh, that's right. Nick said, yes, it's out in paperback now as of this month. Dominic is a venture capitalist, read my book in the early stages of the pandemic lockdown, contacted me, said, hey, could we have a meeting? So he's in Massachusetts. I'm here in Columbus. And we started talking. We had some mutual interests. He really liked the ideas in my book. Long story short, the idea of this book came out of our conversations. It was initially going to be an article. We pitched this idea to my publisher at Johns Hopkins. He said, I love this. Yeah, turn it into a book. We'd love to have this as a book. And so Dominic and I had Zoom meetings, shared documents through Google Docs. I say this all to sort of say that Dominic and I have never met face to face to this day. We keep saying we're going to have to get together and meet face to face, but we are proof positive of what the distribution of knowledge workers throughout the country can produce, what's possible when knowledge workers can work from anywhere. And with that, I'm happy to take some questions.
Thanks so much, Dave, for that really fascinating presentation and that sort of sense of kind of bringing us from past into present. We got a lot of questions that have come in. Let me bring a few together. We had a few questions. And let me just say to folks out there with us today, if you'd like to ask a question, you can see some of them that have been posted already. Please just type it in the Q&A and we'll do our best to kind of work our way through them. There's a few questions just kind of trying to clarify what's going on in terms of the movement or not movement of people that I'm going to try to put together. So you started with colleges closing or struggling or this sort of thing. Can you talk a little bit about why that's happening? Is it that people are not going to college anymore, maybe go on to different, you know, doing sort of skill training or something else? Is it that they're not going to specific colleges because they want to leave an area or not interested in going to a certain area? And related, but not related to this, are you seeing any changes in terms of the remote working trend? I mean, is it starting to decrease the further we move away from the COVID moment?
So let me take the last question first. And I think, so I'll phrase it this way. I think that workers want to work remotely, or to, at the very least, to have more control over their time or how they use their time. I think it's companies that are pushing back against remote work. And what we're seeing actually is a tension in those two. You'll sometimes see in the press, it's like, oh, well, you know, the remote work is done. Companies want their workers to come back. That's absolutely true. It's workers that don't want to come back. And we're watching that clash occurring every day now, frankly. The need, the desire among workers is still there. The first part of your question, the first question is a little more complex, I think. So in just the boldest of terms, as long as colleges and universities are thinking about their customers as 18 to 24 year olds, they're just simply fewer of them. And we've known this for at least a decade. In fact, it was called, the name given for it is the demographic cliff. There was a not a baby boom like the baby boom generation, but there was a baby boom of millennials. After the millennials, though, we've watched birth rates drop, not precipitously, but have dropped, such that we've known for some time that just the number of traditional age students were just going to simply be fewer. And so you have a situation now where you have colleges and universities fighting for a smaller pie or looking to carve up a shrinking pie. Part of what we're arguing in the book is that to thrive, colleges and universities need to think beyond traditional 18 to 24 year olds, which is why I say we're looking that the purpose, the mission of your institution should be to serve not just simply that population, but a different and older population. Indeed, maybe those who've already graduated from college and university. So, for instance, we talk about setting up incubators or making the knowledge enterprise the node in the larger knowledge economy. We're talking about having knowledge workers set up shop on their campus, setting up what amounts to co-working spaces. Come move here and we'll give you an office. We'll give you access to the expertise at our institution. We have something, it's not exactly like that at Ohio State, but companies have access to the expertise here at Ohio State. We're talking about something like that for even smaller colleges and universities. So there's that whole issue. Something else we talk about in the book is thinking about retirees. We already have, and Nick, I know you're aware of this, we have Project 60 here at Ohio State, or Program 60 here at Ohio State. If you're 60, and it might be 65, but if you're 60 years of age and older, you can take any class at Ohio State, as long as you're not displacing a tuition-paying student. We think that I hate to use the language of economics, but we think there's a market there of baby boomers who are hungering for intellectual engagement. And we think that that's a market segment, again, to use the language of business economics, we think that's a market segment that college and universities could be attracting. There are other things, there are questions now in ways that we haven't seen, well, maybe since the Second World War. There are questions now about the value of a college degree, even though all the evidence suggests that, more than suggests, that those with college degrees over their lifetimes have greater earning outcomes than people without college degrees. But this is having an impact on enrollments in a number of places. So those are the factors that have been influencing why some colleges and universities, and if they're not closing, they're starting to shrink. Which in some ways is a step taken before they start closing. See West Virginia.
Sorry, no, go ahead.
No, I say see West Virginia University as a leading example. Sorry.
Right. We've had a few questions about, in some ways, kind of how to make this happen, given the current demographic funding structures, institutional infrastructure kind of realities. Let me put a couple of questions together. So one is interested in what's the place of local, and I'm going to add, state or federal government, and also a local business community in helping to develop knowledge towns. And in particular, because there are many regions of our country that don't have access to kind of the most up-to-date digital infrastructure, and that many of these places, it's going to take, and here I'm quoting the question, time, people, and money for many kind of rural areas or smaller towns to build that kind of infrastructure. What do you suggest for how people can advocate for themselves in these kinds of smaller rural communities to be able to overcome a kind of lack of resources in order to be able to help themselves?
So let me take the second part of that question first, because that it's a super important point. So one of the arguments we make in the book, just to take the idea of digital infrastructure, it's one of the challenges in Ohio. Certainly, it's one of the challenges facing small towns and rural areas: lack of access to broadband, and just in terms of economic development, it's very difficult to attract businesses to a region if there's not reliable broadband. And this is something that in Ohio, state legislators have been wrestling with for almost two decades now they've been wrestling with it for a long time. And one of the arguments we make in the book is that this is a role that that an existing college and university can play. So this has probably been about 10 years or so ago now, and this was in Cleveland, but it was, I want to say it was Case Western, it might have been Cleveland State, began a program of expanding access to the neighborhood surrounding the campus, because the campus had access and need for that sort of infrastructure. They saw as their civic duty to extend that outward. And oftentimes it's the college or university that can play that role in negotiating with the providers. So I did some consulting a number of years ago at DePaul University in Indiana, which is in Greencastle, which is, again, this small town, about an hour or so outside Indianapolis. Again, broadband, broadband internet connectivity at this institution in Greencastle, Indiana. Now, I don't think at the time, in fact, I think I was advocating for it, that DePaul could be extending that outward, extending that service outward. Because what other institution in small towns and rural areas has that sort of capacity, has that sort of clout? Again, that's a very different way of thinking about the mission and purpose of a college or university. Again, one of the arguments we make in the book is that it means these colleges will have to start taking the places in which they reside more seriously, not just simply in terms of economic development. Maybe it's in terms of the research agenda of their faculty. Research and solve local problems, for instance. Have students do research of interest and of impact for their local areas, their local regions. That's one of the approaches we take. Remind me, the first question again was about how to make it happen, or?
Excuse me, the role of... really kind of thinking about the role of government and local government, local business in making all of this happen.
Yes, and maybe such a question answers itself. I think that it's certainly one of the things that we emphasize in the book, that in as much, well, so let's just take business, first of all, especially in small towns, the places where I've done consulting, the business people in town or the civic leaders, of whatever stripe they might be, are very appreciative of having a college or university in their town. There was one small town I was doing some consulting in, and the city manager said to me point blank, we've got a state university right here next door to us. What town wouldn't want that? And so I think that there's already a sort of a sense of the value and the importance that a college or university can play. I think what oftentimes doesn't happen is the way in which business and the college can interact together towards shared goals. It's that coordination that's oftentimes lacking. So I think in as much as we make any sort of, we make all sorts of recommendations in the book, one of those recommendations is learning to get those groups and I think local government to coordinate, to see that they have the same goals and plans and initiatives. State government can certainly play a role in this. I've been trying to get the book in the hands of state leaders to get them to think about economic development here in the state of Ohio. But that also means a change in mentality, a change of thinking about the leaders of colleges and universities, who I think don't always like to think in these terms and certainly aren't thinking in terms of economic development. I'm not going to point to any institution in particular. I talked about how a college or a campus tends to be sort of isolated over here in one part of town. You see that in all sorts of areas. The college is its own sort of island over here and is aloof from what's happening in the surrounding areas. And if they're connected anyway, they're connected like in a network to other colleges and universities, but pay scant attention to the areas in which they reside. And it's changing that relationship or getting a college or university to rethink their purpose and mission that's really at the heart of the book.
Just to kind of build off of what you're saying there, there's a series of questions that are kind of responding to your discussion of kind of developing fourth places of the ideas, the 15-minute city. And so let me just bring all these to kind of together for you. The first sort of, and so I'll talk about fourth place first, where does the condensing into fourth places negate the kind of outward directed work of colleges? Is community membership, community engagement, 15-minute city, are those things undermined when the knowledge enterprise becomes self-contained? And Kind of related to that, in what ways do fourth places and the kinds of buildings that you were showing, how does that connect with questions of affordable housing or gentrification? Who is excluded from the fourth place in the process of building and in the way in which these kinds of fourth places are structured?
In the way that we argue it and structure the book, it's not just the creation of a fourth place. It's centered around affordable housing. That really is the theme in the book, that it's not just housing for the sake of housing. It's affordable housing. I'm appreciative of the question about who does this exclude. The idea here is that affordable housing is excluding all sorts of people right now. The tricky part, and maybe this gets us more into the first part of the question, is: are colleges and universities set up to engage in that sort of enterprise? That's where the heavy lift is. So affordable housing is one challenge, is one set of challenges. Does the institution have the capacity to engage in this? That's why I give the example of Columbus State. Columbus State is sort of a model that we're talking about here, that what they're planning is both affordable housing, and as you read the article, some of that housing is for students, especially for students in need. Not all of it, but some of it. Otterbein University to the north of us in Westerville has, I don't know how affordable it is. That's why I want to hedge here. I don't know how affordable a housing it is, but they have been working with a real estate developer to develop housing near the campus. That gets then to the first question about what does this sort of fourth place neighborhood structure do to the idea of the expansive 15-minute campus? The examples that I cite are all from urban areas. And so part of what, we don't use this term in the book, but Dominic and I have started using this term to talk about the knowledge towns idea as applied to a big city. And we're starting to use the term knowledge neighborhood. That sort of structure is what we're imagining for larger cities. When we talk about a fourth place, especially in a small town, it doesn't need to be so narrowly confined. Again, it could look like something like SCAD, where the housing, for instance, attached to SCAD is something that is spread throughout the city. And again, it's not necessarily concentrated in one area. So we meant fourth place in a sort of a metaphorical sense. The way it tends to get built, however, and again, the examples I show are from urban areas. But that's not the form that they need take in a small town, not at all. All of this, though, is around the idea that colleges, universities get into the housing business. And I understand that's a heavy lift. That's a heavy lift for a lot of places. Yeah.
And presumably, if they get into the housing business, they need to be not just getting into it, but collaborating and partnering with the communities to meet the needs and aspirations of the communities that they're now entering into.
No question.
Let me throw two more questions. These are actually unrelated, but I'd like to throw them out together so you can answer just as we're coming towards time. The first is, how does a college's endowment play into its kind of resilience in the digital economy, and how does it play into its ability to transform from a traditional college into a knowledge, the kind of knowledge hub? And the second, this is unrelated, but I'm going to throw it out too, is a kind of more political question. And here I'll just quote the question entirely. It says, there's recent data that indicates folks with a conservative political point of view are increasingly distrustful of colleges and universities. And we know the conservative political points of view are especially represented in rural and small town areas. Does this create an obstacle to implementing what you're talking about? Could local opposition develop to colleges expanding their role in the attraction of knowledge workers?
Let me try to tackle the last question. I don't, that's been my pattern, right? I challenge or address the second question. So I think the question asker absolutely has a point, and yes, those conservative that conservative response tends to be in rural areas. That is oftentimes a, well, there's a number of sources from that. Some of that reaction has to do with what's perceived to be the political bias on campus. But you talk, you survey the same groups and ask them about the economic role that the college or university plays, and they're happy with that. They're happy with that role. So in some ways, it's about sort of bifurcating what they mean by a university. And I don't mean to speak for the conservative perspective here, but that's my reading of the situation. Again, many of the places where I've worked, they're very appreciative of the college and the university in their town. They don't always like what professors are teaching or what students are, you know, the kind of speakers that students are bringing to campus. But they don't want to see the college or university leave. I won't mention name. There's a city in Ohio that within the last decade lost its college, right? And this was a terrible, terrible loss. This is perceived as a terrible loss, and they weren't talking about the intellectual life that that the university brought to the area. They really were talking about not just the economic development possibilities, the prestige. Having a university in your town is good for promoting the city, good for promoting the city. But having said all that, I think the question asker is absolutely right. It does represent a challenge, I think, for the Knowledge Town strategy. And we could get into other sorts of things about, well, we're out of time. I could ask other things about this. What was the first question again?
What's the role of the kind of size of endowment of the university? I mean, I suppose more broadly, yeah. The kind of the range of resources, which reflects size of college or the kind of endowments. I mean, in what ways does your vision in some ways privilege those who might have already greater resources in terms of university education?
Yeah, no, this is a really good question. And part of the reason it's good is that this was something that Dominic and I had very, very long debates about. So part of our process of writing this book together at a distance was that we would have these moments where Dominic would be making one set of arguments, and I'd sort of say, well, okay, sure, you know, maybe that's not exactly the way I would phrase it, but okay, that's fine. This was one that we had some clashes on, because I said, especially when we were talking about a knowledge enterprise being a venture capitalist fund, he said, well, you know, 10% of an endowment could be given or something like that. I said, Dominic, hold on. I said, I said a lot of the places that I taught didn't have endowments that were anywhere near that sort of size. And so we had this debate back and forth. He makes a really good case in the book for, I mean, you don't have to be a Harvard. You don't even have to be like a Williams College. You don't need to have hundreds of millions of dollars. But to have an effective venture fund that could be pulled out of an endowment. The other thing that we argue in the book, and maybe this was more my orientation, is that building an endowment becomes part of fundraising, becomes part of the fundraising initiatives of a college or university. And again, that means they have to change their thinking. They have to change their orientation. It means building off of existing capacity, but it really does mean a new purpose. I say in the book, that probably means a new position, right? The vice president for venture funds or something like that. That will anger a lot of people. I know that. I write that in the book. That will anger a lot of people in colleges and universities. It's about the choice that a college or university can make to develop this capacity. But it ultimately is a choice.
Thank you so much, Dave. And thank you all very much for joining us today and for your excellent questions. We got through almost all of them, and I appreciate all your insight and thoughtfulness. I'm grateful to David Staley for sharing his expertise with us today. Please join me in giving him a virtual round of applause.
Thank you,
Dr. Staley. And we'd also like to thank the College of Arts and Sciences, especially Alex Stacklane, the Department of History, the Goldberg Center, and the Clio Society, and Origins Current Events and Historical Perspective for their support. Please stay safe and healthy, and we'll see you next time. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.